Welcome to the Advisor Advocates Podcast. My name is Garrett Lill. I'm a certified financial planner and former advisor. And I started Advisor Advocates in this podcast to share with other advisors some of the experience that I like to say I accidentally accumulated over the course of my 13-year career, especially around the areas of the industry involving transitions from one firm to the other, advisor recruiting, M&A deals, things of that nature. Interesting thing for advisors that I've experienced in my career is that advisors are often on an island. We don't really know what's out there. We don't know what's going on outside the walls of our firm and outside the confines of our own practices. Especially when I was working in the recruiting industry and talking with advisors, there were just so many advisors who didn't know what they didn't know. So the purpose of this podcast and Advisor Advocates is to help bridge that information gap, to help advisors understand a little bit more about what the landscape looks like out there, what options are available to you, and sort of share some of the insights that I've ran into and hopefully answer some of the most common questions that advisors have. Before we get into this episode, I just want to say, ironically, I suppose, if you want to call it that, this episode was recorded on September 26th, and my guest, Scott Steele, is a resident of the mountains of North Carolina, and you hear a reference towards the end of the show where I wish him well during the storms, and little did either of us know the type of devastation and the type of storms that were about to hit the mountains of North Carolina over the next couple of days. And I'm very thankful that Scott and his family are okay. Had a chance to speak with him, but there are a lot of families and a lot of folks in the western part of the state who have suffered an unimaginable amount of loss. So I just wanted to take a minute before we get into the show to encourage anyone out there who hears this podcast or sees this on YouTube or sees it on the website to consider contributing what you can. I'm going to provide a few links in the description of some legitimate and very needy causes that are out there from some folks that do need some help in the biggest way. So most of us and most people who are listening to this podcast or seeing this on YouTube, and myself included, can't really imagine going through what some of these folks are. But I grew up near the mountains of North Carolina, about an hour or so away from some of the areas that were impacted quite a bit. And this is just one of these that I've seen and heard firsthand stories of some really rough stuff that those folks are going through. So I just want to ask for you to give some serious consideration to contributing what you can, because I know there's a lot of folks out there with a lot of needs that could use a lot of help. So I do want to ask as sincerely as I possibly can to please consider contributing if you're able to do so in any way that you can. And with that being said, let's get to the show.
I am really excited to have Scott Steele with me. I'm always excited anytime I've got anybody on here with me. I get so tired of just sitting here and recording these things, looking at an iPhone by myself in a room. So it's nice to have somebody else on the other side of the conversation. But really appreciate you being with me today, Scott. It's been a real privilege and a pleasure getting to know you over the last few weeks. I just love your approach to the industry and the way you handle things. So for the listeners and viewers, Scott Steele is the business development consultant dedicated to the RIA channel for Raymond James. I've had a really good time just getting to know you and learning your approach to the industry. I'm looking forward to this conversation today, Scott. So appreciate you joining me.
No, I appreciate you inviting me on, and I look forward to our conversation.
So Scott, we've talked a lot over the last little bit and about just the different varieties of independence. And I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, when an advisor talked about going independent, that meant one thing. I think now I talk to a lot of advisors who say they want to go independent, and it may mean a slightly different thing. Sometimes advisors say they want to go independent, and they really have no idea what they mean by it exactly. They may think that they mean one thing, and in reality, they may mean something a little bit different. So from your experience, now, what's the first step for an advisor who's, you know, maybe they're in an employee channel right now, and they know that they're unhappy for whatever reason. It may be because they're not getting paid as much as they'd like. It may be that they're dissatisfied with the offering, or a variety of reasons, and they decide, I'm going independent. Is that by itself, I mean, this is a loaded question, is that by itself enough to tell them which direction they're going, or what other questions are they going to start asking?
Don't we wish? And it's really one of the things we need to identify early on. I start every conversation with pretty much the same question. Rather than me spend the next 10 to 15 minutes giving you a commercial about my firm, Tell me what's going on in your world that's causing you to have a conversation with somebody like me. And what I'm looking for there, you know, you had mentioned pain point. Oftentimes it's not a pain point. Maybe it's a frustration. Are they looking for more freedom and flexibility? Are they entrepreneurial? They want to own something. Are they realizing, hey, I'd like to build enterprise value and maybe monetize it at a higher value in the future? Because if they say, I'm going independent, independence is a broad spectrum. It could be 1099 independent. It could be pure business owner RIA independence. And there's a whole slew of variations between those two points. So I try to start off with a very open-ended question, getting them to identify the catalyst. And I would say 95% of the time, that is the start of the conversation, and then we take it from there.
And I love the way you said it. I kind of take a similar approach, I think, and I've kind of coined this term as my way of saying it, I guess, is the blank canvas approach. So rather than going in with a list of questions and saying, okay, me asking, how do you feel about this? What are you looking for with that? I really do find it more productive if I just tell the advisor, hey, you called me for a reason. What, how can I help? You know, tell me what prompted you to call me, or tell me, you know, you let them tell the story, because I think the recruiting industry and what I experienced from working with other recruiters is that recruiters are trying to fit advisors into the right box, right? So this, you know, I'm talking to this advisor, how quickly can we figure out, do they fit in box A, box B, box C? And I think a lot of times advisors, similar to clients in a way, for advisors that work with clients, I mean, yes, there may be some commonalities. There may be some similar features that, you know, overlay one client to the next. But each individual, each advisor, each practice has a something that makes them particularly unique. And it's better to hear it maybe in their words a lot of times. There's always going to be something or a series of features really that are going to be unique to each situation. What are some of the most common answers you get to that question, though? I guess when you ask someone, why are you calling? What are you what's missing now? What is it that prompted you to have this conversation? What are the things that you hear most often from advisors?
I would say, aside from material changes, like something has happened at the firm, I'm experiencing reputational risk with the firm that I'm currently working with. Outside of that, it really comes down to freedom and flexibility. And they describe freedom and flexibility in any of a number of different ways. It may be, and I hear this a lot, I am tired of being managed to the lowest common denominator. And oftentimes they're feeling that from a compliance perspective. And it's not as though they're running away from compliance or they're rogue advisors. Furthest thing from that, they are running very clean practices, and they find themselves, because every major firm, including Raymond James, we have to look out for the whole. But in the independent space, specifically in the RIA space, the compliance is your personalized compliance. You're not being dictated by what somebody across the street may have done. If you're running a clean shop, bread and butter, it can even have some complexity to it. The compliance oversight is going to be yours. That is one of the more common. Service is another one. Oftentimes, the major firms can allocate resources, but those resources may not come your way. And to be able to step into the world of independence and control those dynamics is very, very appealing. It used to be you had to be at a major wirehouse firm in many cases to have the resources, technology, product suites, brand name. With the advancements in technology, those things are a thing of the past. So I would say it's typically something around freedom and flexibility. If it comes down, if the first conversation is around compensation, there's going to be a bit of a disconnect there. Because while the RIA space is the highest compensation levels in the industry, oftentimes it's not so much about that as it is about what your upfront offer. that's not really in the realm of the RIA space. There are ways to capture that, but that's not a place I typically play in.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you start your own RIA, to expect to get a signing bonus or a transition bonus to start your own company is, I mean, I don't mean to be offensive to anyone out there, but I mean, that's a, what's the word for dumb without sounding understanding? It doesn't make any sense for me when you think you're going to get paid to start a business in that regard. Now, yeah, sure. If you're joining the 1099 channel, there's some upfront bonus money to some extent there. And I know what you're referring to and where it can come from. But I think just in general, when I talk to advisors, when a transition bonus comes up, I'm not trying to alienate anybody or say anything, you know, to condemn the practice. It's not that. Certainly there are situations where transition bonuses make sense. There are situations where it may be the best thing for an advisor, but it's surprising to me how many advisors, despite our nature and the way we work with clients to do what's best in the long-term financial future, financial advisors a lot of times will take the short-term solution without necessarily factoring in what's best long-term. And that great big transition bonus that they got comes at the expense of a haircut on the payout for 10 years, or they're giving up a part of their business, or they, you know, there's a laundry list of reasons that may be causing problems down the road. But advisors can neglect that a lot of times and take the short-term payday, maybe even knowing that it's after 5 years or 6 years or 8 years, they would have been better off to have gone a different direction. So I don't want to say I discourage the practice, but I at least want advisors to do the math, you know, and make sure that they're thinking big picture about those things.
Well, as you had mentioned, Garrett, or as you and I had spoken about earlier, the dynamic of that first conversation, I try to stress that I act very much as a consultant. It is not about Raymond James. It cannot be about any custodian in that first conversation, because there are so many unknowns that have to be brought to the surface. And it literally is just a conversation like you and I are having right now, where I've been doing this now almost 9 years. I know the questions I want to ask that try to get me to a fork in the road, of many forks in the road that are going to have to be identified. When you have that two-way conversation with the individual on the other side of you, you've got something. And whether it's going to be somebody who's going to move into the RIA space, I don't know. And it's just a matter of us having that open conversation. If you're in a situation where you're exploring, you'll be surprised at how much you really don't understand of the nuances. It is not complicated at all, but you need somebody like you or me who's acting as a consultant just to come in and have that open dialogue, because we can carve off months of due diligence if somebody is having an open conversation and allowing us to ask the questions that are steering us somewhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be coming to me, but I take pleasure and enjoyment in helping the individuals find that path.
I know one of the things that it definitely resonated with me that you just said about getting frustrated with being managed to the lowest common denominator. That takes place a lot, and that can be a frustration point for a lot of advisors, because you're right. Compliance is, when I started my RIA, I love the freedom in it. And when I would talk to clients, I would be able to say, I had clients come to me all the time and say, can you do this? Can you do that? And my answer eventually became pretty simple. If it's legal, I can do it. There was nothing restricting me. There was nothing that kept me from being able to do anything that I wanted, I thought was best, and the way I wanted to run my business. Now, for me, that also created a little bit of a problem, because I had so much freedom and I'm so entrepreneurial and creative minded that I spent a lot of my time chasing my tail with all these great, brilliant ideas that I had, and not enough time just doing what I, you know, needed to be doing to run my business. But I loved that freedom. And I remember a point in time where I wanted to start a second business and I wasn't really sure how those would interact with one another, and, you know, what I needed to put on my ABV and what I didn't. And I ended up leveraging the third party compliance consultant that I was using at that time. They sort of gave me an answer, but their answer was, I mean, essentially, we can guide you and tell you what the law says about this, if it's your decision, it's your firm. Now, that also comes at the flip side of that, and I talked about this in some of my other podcasts, that there's also no one necessarily insulating you from the regulator there if you get it wrong. You know, if you, you know, you do have compliance consultants that are out there, and you can hire a chief compliance officer. There's a lot of ways that you can account for that compliance oversight, or that you can manage that compliance oversight. But no matter who it is, whether it's you signing it, or you hire a chief compliance officer, or you outsource it to a third party, if that person makes a mistake and the regulator comes knocking, it's you who's going to be answering the door and answering those questions and responding to the complaints of the violations that they're alleging. So that's a double-edged sword in a way. It can kind of go either way.
Well, it's a big fear that I think is being planted, definitely in, let's say, the wirehouse environment, where you will hear, oh, I was under the impression that compliance is really going to be complicated. If something goes wrong, it could put my career out of whack. It really is not complicated at all. For example, if you're in the 1099 independent business contractor division or space, you're under FINRA because the broker dealer is under FINRA. So the broker dealer owns your compliance. You're still going to be managed to the lowest common denominator. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just the structure of FINRA. Every firm on the street is governed by those rules. When you step into the RIA space, you have advisors that may have the staff that is very competent, and they say, I'm going to do it in-house because I've got somebody who can do this. Then you've got third-party strategic partners that are outsourced compliance firms that you can hire at different levels of engagement. And then on the far side, you have compliance firms that will act as your chief compliance officer, actually their name appearing on your Form ADV. And it just comes down to, what does the advisor feel most comfortable with? There's the spectrum. I am a huge proponent of hire a third-party strategic partner for at least the first 1 or 2 years. The amount of money you're going to spend for that is minuscule. You will probably come to the conclusion that I'm going to keep them on going forward because it's just not that much money, even if you've got somebody in-house who's helping you. But they're looking over your shoulder. And I mean, the closest analogy I've got right now is I'm acting as owner contractor of a home I'm building here. Thank goodness I found a contractor that said, oh, I'll act as your contractor consultant and I'll look over your shoulder. The stress this individual has saved me, and even the money he has saved me, is well worth it. I would encourage everybody to find a partner who's looking over your shoulder, especially when it comes to something as important as compliance. And then if you want to hire an outsourced chief compliance officer, they are available. But don't let somebody tell you or keep you from moving more towards independence because they're trying to scare you with the concept of owning the compliance oversight. It is not as bad as people try to make it out to be.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I also would echo the recommendation of using third-party compliance consultants for the first couple of years at least, because that's exactly what I did when I started my own. You know, my progression through my career, I started in the W-2 channel and then went to an independent broker-dealer. And then there, I learned so much about the way the industry really worked to realize that the jump from where I'm at now to starting my own RIA and having total independence is a whole lot easier than maybe what I thought it was. But the one gap that was still there was compliance, frankly. I mean, that was something I didn't have a lot of knowledge of. And I knew it was important, so I did hire somebody for that. And it took me a few years before I finally, toward the very end, just a year or two before I sold my firm, I finally got to the point where I realized that I was, if you divided out the time it would take me to do the things that they were helping me with by the cost of what I was spending with them, it was probably not worth it. And that was really just the last couple of years, because by that point, I had really kind of figured out my compliance, and it also figured out my business model, and I wasn't chasing my tail quite as much as I was maybe in the first couple of years. I needed them on call for those first couple of years because I was constantly coming up with these new ideas and saying, can I do this, and how does this work? And I didn't know what I didn't know yet, and I was leaning on them. But there is that independence that you get. And also, if you are running a normal practice, okay, and when I say normal, I'm talking about a kind of practice that's probably going to encompass 90% of firms out there. I was way on the edge. I mean, I was doing a lot of options trading, and I was doing a lot of different outside business activities and marketing activities, and there were always all these ideas. I'm very, like I said, entrepreneurial and coming up with all these different things. But if you're running a practice where you sit down with wealthy individuals, do financial planning, manage their portfolios in stocks, bonds, mutual funds, managed accounts, third-party money managers, whatever, running your practice the way 90% of other advisors are at a high level, then your compliance is not going to be that complicated. It's not going to be that expensive, and you're not going to be walking a tightrope of in any area of your business anyway. So it's you're not taking any big chances in that area.
I spent 30 years at the major wirehouses, and admittedly, you don't have any gunslingers typically coming out of a major wirehouse. The compliance is, you know, they're under the microscope. They've cleaned that up. Sure, there's always going to be a bad apple, but 99% of the advisors that I engage with, they're running clean businesses. Maybe some are more complex than others. Maybe there's teams. Maybe they're running a family office, or they want to run a family office type of model. It just isn't that complicated when it comes to the compliance, because they're running clean businesses now.
Yeah. If I try to lay out the options for being independent, I think that I would have it kind of covered under three different umbrellas. And you can correct me if you think this is different, but I think that there is sort of what I call the independent tuck-in model. And that's my, I have learned, I need to figure out another way of saying it. When I say tuck-in, that often gets confused with turnkey, which would be my second level. But when I think of a tuck-in model, that is teaming up with a firm that has a brand established. You're going to operate under their flag, but you're going to own your book of business. Economics on that usually fall in the 70 to 80% payout range once you net everything out. And that's a nice middle ground a lot of times between advisors from the wirehouses. You can almost double their income from moving where they're at in the wires to having without having to do anything for themselves. They don't have to do their brand, their website, any of that stuff. Everything's perfect. Then you've got the turnkey RIA, which is going to be you're going to operate under your own brand, have your own flag. You're going to be responsible for, you know, the website and the marketing and all of these types of things. You're going to get a higher payout. But you're basically outsourcing the compliance in a turnkey. There are some other things that a lot of the turnkeys are starting to bring to the table now as well. But at the end of the day, with the turnkeys, you're getting to kind of act and operate like an RIA, but without having to do your own compliance. But they own your ADV. So there is going to be somebody besides you who tells you if this is going to be okay or not, or if you can use this particular strategy, or if you can use this, you know, perform this particular OVA. They're usually going to be pretty reasonable, I think, on those, but it really depends on the firm. And then your final leg is going to be total control, RIA. You own the ADV. You own everything top to bottom. You control all the revenue. Is that a fair overview, I guess, of the industry? And what would you, how would you describe sort of the archetype of the typical advisor that is appropriate for each of those three, right? Because if somebody's trying to decide, well, which of those is right for me, what's your take on that?
Well, and the devil's in the details. unfortunately, painfully, that you cannot assume based on the conversation that you have accurately identified the direction that they're going to go. I am a big fan of the owning your own ADV, being the business owner. But oftentimes, that really comes down to the entrepreneurial streak that's running through the advisor. You hear it, it's like, oh, we're the easy button. Come join us, and we will take care of your registration. We'll take care of your compliance. We've already got marketing contracts set up, so we can roll you into that. Yes, you're going to get a slightly lower payout because we're doing all of these things, but they're very popular to plug in because it comes across as the easy button. But I like to keep reminding myself of how hard it is for advisors to break free from the wirehouse where they typically are, only to go into another model. If you don't think there are restrictive covenants in that model, you haven't done your due diligence. And it's not that it's bad. Nothing is for free. If the RIA that you're looking to plug into has private equity backing, you need to take a step back and remind yourself of what's the typical business model of private equity. Does it align with your goals of your practice and, more importantly, your clients' goals? They are all very successful, vibrant business models. I just find, personally, I get more satisfaction with dealing with the advisors that want to own their own ADV. And even in that space, there are some great strategic partners who will run the business component that frees you up to run the wealth management component. They'll do your compliance. They'll have marketing and product resources available to you to tap into, but you still own your ADV. That, I think, if you're looking for an easy button and still want to own your ADV, a lot of advisors aren't even aware that that's available. But that's where you and I come in to play. If somebody at least is open enough to share what they're looking for, and admittedly, they will go through gyrations where they think they're going in one direction and they realize maybe I need to go in another direction. But I just found it. I typically post on LinkedIn once a week, and it tends to have a similar theme. The super aggregators with private equity backing are almost becoming the next broker dealers because they're having great success. The story of it's the easy button is resonating, and in some ways it is, but it just depends, in my mind, what's your time frame? There is a finite number of years before there's probably going to be a liquidity event or some monetization of that entity. We've seen some in the industry already. None of that necessarily bad, but if I'm going to go through the effort of breaking free, I would like to own my ADV because then I control everything. Maybe I don't want to retire when somebody thinks I should retire. Maybe I have kids that want to come into the industry and I want to become my annuity and let the kids take it over. The sky's the limit. The options are out there, but you just need to sit down with somebody, in my opinion, and have an honest, open dialogue and see where it goes.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting when I talk to advisors about whether they're looking to switch firms, or I guess this conversation would mostly be when somebody's switching firms, but when I talk to an advisor who is going to be joining, especially one of the aggregators or the turnkey RIAs, I think both of those, which are somewhat similar in some ways, but they're not in other ways. But that's one of the big questions that I'm going to get a lot is what's their liquidity plan, or is there a liquidity event? Who owns them? Are they employee owned? Are they founder owned? Or is it, you know, owned by private equity? And here's the thing: even if you join one of those and you're getting a 95% payout, and you own 100% of your book of business, and nobody's telling you what to do other than just being your compliance back office, but when that liquidity event occurs, 3 years, 5 years, 12 years, 2 months down the road, whatever that may be, it's going to affect you. Now, you may be independent and you can make the decision to go with the flow of that deal, or you can take your business elsewhere. But I did experience this firsthand, and this would be one of the more interesting times that I don't use the names, because I don't typically use the names of companies on the podcast unless it's a guest here like you are, because I don't want anybody getting mad at me for saying something I shouldn't have said. But let's just say that one really, really big custodian bought another really, really big custodian that I used a few years ago. And even though I own my book outright, 100%, I was still affected by that decision. I was still affected by that acquisition and by the merging of those two companies together.
And in my particular experience with it, I didn't enjoy that transition as it took place. And so you're still going to be affected, right? I mean, to some extent, you could extend that all the way out to even if you have a mutual fund that you have loved for years and they change portfolio managers, it's going to have an impact in your business, right? But those types of situations are going to be really big, time-consuming things for you to have to work through of either having to find.
Because oftentimes, any material change of ownership may very well change the name of the RIA entity, as an example. So do you have to now have a new client service agreement sent to every client in your book, which just creates another round of questions and having to position it? I'm finding a lot is also coming down to the stage of the advisor in their career. If they are looking at, hey, I'm going to retire in 5 years, probably, maybe I stretch it to six. Oftentimes, they're looking to maximize their value. And perhaps the super aggregators with private equity is the route for them to go, because in 5 years, they're going to take a check and walk away. Again, I go back to what I prefer to play in, the space I prefer to play in are those advisors that don't necessarily plan to exit in 5 years. They say, I've got 10 or 15 years in front of me. Don't get lost with the allure of a large check, because you are absolutely giving up something for that check. As I said before, nothing is free. And I think you will thank me for that guidance at some point in the future, no matter where you go. Because when you own it, you are creating your own enterprise value and you control the timing and the decisions of everything. That to me is very, very appealing. And I think we're going through a cycle where you've already seen the growth of that model. We're also starting to notice some of the cracks, where a number of the CEOs and the original RIA that then took some private equity backing have departed, some willingly, some perhaps not so, but you've seen some starting to go after temporary restraining orders. Those are the things a lot of the advisors I like to work with are trying to get away from. But it's still out there. And look, the model is very, very successful. You know, I can't knock it. It's just not the place, the space I like to play in.
So before we wrap up here, we're probably into bonus time or overtime period at this point, but I do want to ask just a couple of questions here. So I'm familiar with the big players on the custody side. Before our conversations, I wasn't that familiar with the Raymond James side of it. An advisor who starts their own RIA and uses our Raymond James custodial services, kind of outline for me a 90-second overview or so of what they're receiving from Raymond James. What is your role in that? And then also, specifically, does that advisor have the opportunity or the option to be multi-custodial if they choose to be? Because I know that can be, some of the bigger custodians will allow that, or they won't allow that, or they'll raise the minimum to the point that you have to be there. But there's a lot of different rules they have there. So just kind of walk me through, if I'm on your platform, can I use other custodians, and what services or what's Raymond James bringing to the table if I'm using your custody? Yeah, I
appreciate the question. Having spent, as I mentioned earlier, 30 years on the wirehouse side, I try to describe our offering this way. We are the most familiar experience for a wirehouse advisor who's used to having everything at their fingertips, wealth management offering, product suites, technology, investment banking, banking, insurance resources, financial planning resources, and I can go on and on. At Raymond James, you get the exact same offering regardless of which channel affiliation the advisor chooses. But specifically in the RIA world, rather than having to go out there and build it yourself, it's already built, with a couple of key differences. We have a more customized service experience, and we have fully integrated technology across our entire offering. And specific to the RIA only, you have the ability to be multi-custodian, which means you will probably need third-party technology that we integrate with. I couldn't necessarily say that 3 to 5 years ago. Those dynamics have changed. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. We give them the full offering of Raymond James, and we are still only acting as your custodian And if you feel that you want to complement our offering with additional third-party technology, you have the freedom and flexibility to do it.
Awesome, Scott. Well, man, I really appreciate this. And hopefully this is the first of several guest appearances from Scott Steele. I enjoy the conversation. And I always say to advisors, anyone watching the podcast, I appreciate you listening. Appreciate you watching if you're on YouTube. And if I can help in any way, if you have any questions, I think the knack seems to be creating podcasts that create more questions than they answer. So if I've created any questions for you in this show, or if Scott's created any questions that I might can help you with or answer, feel free to give me a call. My number's always in the description, 919-561-2436. You can send me an email to garrett@theadvisoradvocates.com, or you can go to theadvisoradvocates.com website, I believe, /connect. Go to the connect tab and you can find my calendar link. Schedule time to chat with me. Shoot me a text any way that you'd like to reach out. Would love to help if I can. And if there is a need to introduce you to someone like Scott to help dig a little bit deeper and answer any other questions, would be more than happy to do that. Scott, appreciate you being here, and thanks for the conversation. We'll talk again soon, and I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, man.
Yeah, just a bullet. If you're an advisor considering a move to independence, give somebody like Garrett a call. It will be well worth your time because he has resources and expertise that he can help you navigate which path you need to go down. So, Garrett, thanks for having me.
Thank you, man. Appreciate the plug at the end there. That was unscripted and unexpected. Always appreciate it. You stay dry. Are you up in the mountains? I hear we're going to be getting a lot of rain up there in the mountains of North Carolina.
I can see me looking out. It's been raining since about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. We've already got a tree down because the ground's saturated. So,
well, you stay high and dry, and we'll talk soon, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.